Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem van der Horst. In case you aren't familiar with the show yet, in the show I have conversations with creators and thinkers in a variety of fields. They tend to be areas I'm both personally and professionally interested in, such as advertising, branding, marketing and media, creativity, gaming, tabletop games in particular, but not only, design and many different types of design. We typically talk about like their upbringing, their education, their careers, what inspires them and their creative process. They're really intended to be quite in-depth conversations. So they're, generally an hour or longer. The show's now officially listed in the iTunes podcast directory, which is great news, meaning you can subscribe directly on there. The show's also on Stitcher. So if ever you use that, you can either on iTunes or Stitcher or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just search for Ice Cream for Everyone to find it. And I mentioned this because if you enjoy listening, I would hugely appreciate you taking a few minutes to give the show a rating and a review. It really helps other people find the show, and I just want more people to listen to it, really. If ever you want to get in touch with me to give me feedback, ask any questions, or just say hi, you can find all my details on the website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything's spelled out, so just Ice Cream for Everyone. You can also find me or follow me on Twitter. My handle is @HippoWill. And moving on to today's guests, I caught up with James Wallace in London. James is an award-winning game designer. He's also been called the godfather of tabletop indie games. He's been working in the gaming industry since he was like 14, when he started writing and publishing his first fanzine. I first met him a few years ago at a conference called Playful in London, where he was speaking. And of course, when I was looking to interview tabletop game designers, I immediately thought of contacting him, and it was a brilliant, fun conversation. James has an enormous amount of experience designing games and has many stories and experience to share in the show. He's also worked with brands to design games, and the most known games he's worked on are probably a game called Once Upon a Time and another one called The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. He also ran several very successful crowdfunding projects on Kickstarter, the latest of which is to redesign a classic dark comedy satirical role-playing game called Paranoia. He's updating it for the 21st century. We talk about all that during the episode. So I'm just going to stop rambling now, really, and let James speak. Enjoy. Hi, James. Welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're in the South Bank in London at the moment. I usually start with a couple of warming up questions just to ease us up in the interview, particularly that it's the morning and we're having coffee, so I think warming up sounds like pretty appropriate.
It's a cold morning. I could definitely do with some warming up.
I saw on your website and your blog that you had a little section that was like the cheapest consultancy figure is just basically it starts at buy me lunch.
That's right. I've been doing this since the 90s, in fact. Back when I started Hogshead Publishing in late 94, early 95, for some time, it was basically the only British company producing tabletop role-playing games without being attached to a larger American parent. There was Nightfall Games, but they were part of Wizards of the Coast. Previous to that, every company that had started up since Games Workshop had gone bust. And I was able to work out the business model that allowed a British company to survive and compete with the Americans and the Europeans. And it got kind of lonely. So I basically said, I will talk to anyone about how to start a British games company. But in order to get that, you have to buy me lunch.
Yeah.
You know? And the idea is the bigger the lunch you buy me, the longer it lasts, the more consultancy you get.
And that I liked. And I was going to ask you, what was the longest and best, most like opulent meal you managed to get out of it?
There's a restaurant just around the corner from us in Clapham. I share an office with Pelgrane Press, who are also pro fantasy software. There's a little restaurant around the corner called The Dairy, which is fantastic. It's genuinely, I would say, in certainly the top 5%, maybe the top 3% of restaurants in London, maybe even better than that. And they have a taster menu.
Ooh.
That twice now, we've gone in at 1 o'clock, and about 3 o'clock, I've had to go. I'm really sorry, I have to go and pick my children up from school now. and we've been about two-thirds of the way through the menu. It's just fantastic. Yeah. And a couple of people have bought me lunch there,
yeah,
which is That's the one where it's, you know, professional level, existing, large scale clients taking me up on this buy me lunch offer. These days, obviously, I'm not telling them how to start a games company. I'm talking to them about crowdfunding or using games as part of customer engagement or branding exercises, that kind of thing. But the idea is the first session lets us work out, first of all, if I want to be involved in the project.
Yeah.
Secondly, if they want me involved in the project, if we can get along. And it's low risk. It's not no risk.
Yeah.
You know, and if it doesn't work out and I decide these people are idiots, well, I've had lunch
after it. Absolutely. And I saw on a couple of projects, you've been called the godfather of indie games.
Of indie game design, yeah.
Indie game design.
Robin Law has called me that, which is, I think, the highest compliment I've been paid in the industry. I don't know exactly where. I suspect it came from Baron Munchausen, which, if you track it back, is basically the first of what we think of as story games.
Okay.
These days, these small format, GM-less, narrative-based rules-like games. And that came out in 1998 and was a surprise success. No one more surprised than me, I have to say. It was a vanity project. I did it because I'd been running Hogshead for 3 years. It was a company I'd set up to publish my own games, and that simply hadn't happened for financial reasons.
Mm.
And I went, I'm going to do something with my name on it, but I don't have time to write a 250-page book.
Mm.
I'll do a 24-page book. Just for self-satisfaction, and it came out, and it was initially a modest hit, and then a rather bigger hit, and we're coming up for the third. We're doing the third edition next year, which is going to be a big lavish hardback with an American publisher I'm not allowed to talk about.
Okay, cool.
But on the back of that, I did a bunch of, Hogshead released a bunch of other games by other designers, mm-hmm. one of them being Robin Laws, a fantastic game called Pantheon,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the forerunner of the Hillfolk system, the drama system, that has been such a massive success for him. But we also published John Tise's Puppet Land in a really nice edition. We published a thing called Violence by Designer X, who's actually Greg Kostikian, and a bunch of other little small format games that you can play in an hour. And you're done. And this, at the time, was kind of revolutionary.
Mm.
No one else was doing this kind of stuff. And we called them New Style Games, and The Forge, which was nascent at the time, just picked up the idea and ran with it.
We're going to have to explain a lot of the things that you're talking about.
The Forge is where...
A lot of people don't have the kind of gaming knowledge. Okay.
The Forge was a website that was pioneering new game design, but in kind of the traditional format of role-playing games, which are open-ended. Basically, you'll play over a sequence of sessions. Usually you meet once a week in the evening and you'll play for 3 or 4 hours, and you can continue doing that indefinitely. And I have friends who are still playing the campaign of Empire of the Petal Throne that they started playing at university in the early 80s. That campaign continues on a weekly basis.
So which game is that?
Empire of the Petal Throne.
I've not heard of it.
It was the second role-playing game TSR published. Okay. And they did it as a big boxed set.
And TSR are the publishers of Dungeons & Dragons.
The company that created the whole role-playing industry, what we think of as hobby games today, and most of the core game mechanics that you find in role-playing and action video games derive from their work with Dungeons & Dragons. The influential company.
Mm.
So their second game is Emperor of the Petal Throne. Dungeons & Dragons came out, and it was a fantasy game. It's completely generic fantasy. All the world's mythology and folklore is in D&D, and it's a hodgepodge. Empire of the Petal Throne was created by Professor M.A.R. Barker, who was a professor of linguistics, I believe, at the University of Minnesota. And he had been working on this game basically most of his life, except it wasn't originally a game, it was just a world. He created the world in the same way that Tolkien created Middle-earth, for his own amusement. But the difference is that Barker is a linguist and an anthropologist, and created this amazingly detailed, fascinating society. It's set in the far future on what was a pleasure planet, a vacation planet that falls into a galactic rift, and 10,000 years pass and they lose their technology, or they lose their understanding of technology. Some of the technology still exists and is regarded as high magic, but at the same time there are the alien races with whom the humans have conquered the galaxy. There are the native races from the original planet, and there are the gods, because it's a galactic rift where gods are real and manifest and are vicious and unpleasant, unknowable beings. And it's this, I mean, the thing it's closest to is the Incan civilizations, but it's its own animal, and it's just delightful and unique. It's not what we think of as an adventure game. There aren't, I mean, there are adventures to be had, but a lot of it is just interacting with the, within the society, being part of a clan, being part of the various social strata, the temple organizations. It's mapped out in a detail unlike almost any role-playing game I've. The only thing I would compare it to is RuneQuest, which is another one of the great culture-based games. But RuneQuest is Bronze Age, specifically. Mm. Emperor of the Battle Throne, they have no metals. They have gold. But almost everything, because the planet has no native metals, they have to make everything out of cured Schlen hide. The Schlen being the beast of burden, a six-legged thing. Think of a six-legged rhinoceros with a heavy hide. But it's not. It does about 3 miles an hour at top speed. So they've got no horses. They've got no fast animals. So if they want to send a message from one city to the next, they have to run. And it's just the dynamics of the whole thing, because Barker's a social scientist. He works through all of this stuff, and everything influences everything else. Mm-hmm. And it just feels so real and living as a culture. It's an amazing game to play.
Mm-hmm.
And has it's never really found a big market, perhaps because the barrier to entry is so high. You have to assimilate an awful lot of the information about the culture to be able to run the game as the games master, as the referee. The players, it's one of the first games to actually use the mechanic for introducing the players to the world that a lot of video games do now, which is to allow the player to experience the world as the same time as their character, rather than dropping a character, you into the world and going, you're a 40-year-old merchant, you've lived here all your life, and you're supposed to know all this stuff. They say, you're a barbarian from Haida Pakala, the barbarous lands to the south, and you've come north to the Solyani Empire to seek your fortune. And the game begins, the first adventure, as you set foot on the docks at Jakala, the great port, and you're looking around going, oh, wow. And your character knows nothing of this place and could barely speak the language. And you, as the player, are picking up the information and understanding this at the same rate as your character. So there's no information that your character ought to have that you, as the player, don't. And it works brilliantly. And the game is just... I mean, the original edition used Dungeons & Dragons mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit clunky and it's very combat orientated because it was the 70s. We were still, TSR was still working out what these games could be. We didn't know back then. But it's a glorious, glorious game. Yeah. Some of my favorite role-playing experiences have been in Petal Throne.
I want to track back a tiny bit.
Okay, sorry, I've been burping.
No, it's fine. That was fascinating because I'd never heard about that game, which obviously there's loads of gaps, but it's very interesting. I thought the first ones were... Anyway, let's track back because we're going to come back to that. But I'd like to know, where did you start? Like, what's your background and where you grew up and how what you studied and how you got into gaming, basically? Okay. Yeah, let's start there.
I got into gaming by accident.
Okay.
I'm British, born and bred, born in East Anglia, but I went to boarding school, and boarding school is an amazingly fertile atmosphere for developing the gaming hobby because, you know, adolescent boys with time on their hands, in my case, a secluded all-male society.
Did you study boarding school in East Anglia as well?
No. That was just west of London, just outside Windsor.
Okay.
And... I was introduced there to... I'd played board games before, and as a family, we played a lot of the traditional card games. And I enjoyed those, but I wasn't fascinated by them. But I was introduced to Dungeons & Dragons and Traveller pretty much simultaneously in 1981, and then shortly thereafter, Call of Cthulhu. And it just clicked. It was this other world that... I didn't enjoy boarding school at all. I had a fairly hellish time.
Mm.
And here were these worlds that I could inhabit and escape to and have fun and explore, and basically hitting all the Bartle player types. If you know Dr. Bartle, Professor Bartle, Richard Bartle of the University of Essex, the man who basically created multiplayer gaming as we understand it. He developed the multi-user dungeons using the University of Essex's mainframe back in the late 70s, early 80s. Oh,
wow. Can you explain that? Because So we need to explain probably for the people who don't know what a multi-user dungeon is.
Okay, a multi-user dungeon is basically, it's an online game, but it's text-based because this is the late 70s or the early 80s.
Yeah.
The graphics simply aren't there. They're such an overhead on memory. And indeed, the way that the computers talk to each other, which at the time in the UK was over JANET, the Joint Academic Network, which was one of the forerunners of the internet. In the States, everyone talks about the ARPANET, the military applications. Over here, it was Janet. But so people at different universities around the country could play this game, and you'd get a text description of the room that you were in and who else was there. Yeah. And by typing the command "say," your character within the world would say something, and everyone else would get that displayed on their screen. And this sounds amazingly primitive now.
I used to play a Dragon Riders of Pern multi-user dungeon in the 90s in Paris, actually.
Wow.
So Anne McCaffrey's series of books called The Dragon Riders of Pern. And isn't it interesting that this is just the very beginning of the internet, before the web, right?
Yes.
And some of the first things that people were doing alongside sending messages were playing games.
Completely, yes. And using games to explore the possibilities of what games can be. In the original Muds and Mushes, I can't remember what what Mush stands for, but as you increased with level within the game, as your character became more powerful, you gained more access to the programming language behind the game.
Really?
You could become a wizard, and a wizard was someone who had admin powers and could physically alter the game and the rules by which the game runs. And that's pretty interesting. But Bartle has gone on to do an awful lot of interesting game design and interesting academic work about games. And he breaks players down into, based on his observation of the way people are playing MUDs, he says there are four types of players. There are achievers who want to do everything you can do within a game. There are explorers who want to see everything that you can see. They want to test the outer limits of the game. There are socializers who want to hang out with other people and have a good time. And there are killers who want to kill stuff. Possibly other players, other characters rather, but mostly that's where they get their jollies. And obviously players, no one person is just one point on that spectrum. Mm. We all inhabit a greater or larger number of those variables. But I was getting all of those from Dungeons & Dragons. It was pressing all my buttons. Mm. And very quickly, I saw a games fanzine, a role-playing game fanzine.
Sorry, just one second. Yeah. But you touched on it just earlier on storytelling, but one thing I asked, and I had an interview with John Wick, which is also on the podcast, and I asked him the same question. I'm probably going to ask the same question to several people. But for the people who don't really know role-playing games, vaguely heard about it, or I usually describe it, or I fall back to Dungeons & Dragons if I don't really want to spend much time explaining it, even though I don't really play much Dungeons & Dragons. But how do you explain what role-playing games are to like somebody who doesn't know anything about it, so somebody who's listening and might not know anything about it?
It's like the best analogy, and I've been thinking about this for the best part of 30
years.
That's
why it's interesting, because I know there are a lot of people inquiring into how you describe it, and it's still evolving. It's one of the most recent forms of gaming, isn't it?
It is. If you think about it, it's like improv theatre. Mm. You've got a director, and you've got a troupe of actors. The actors know the characters that they're inhabiting, but they know nothing else. And they will talk among themselves, and the director will throw directions at them, or will tell them what's going on. And that's very much the same thing. The director in a role-playing game is the dungeon master. They know the plot. They know the setting. They know the plot. They are the story guide, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then the actors are the players with their characters. And they want to, they have short-term and long-term goals. Usually, kill stuff, get treasure in Dungeons & Dragons. In other games, it's more nuanced, thankfully. But again, the dungeon master will describe where you are, and ask you what you want to do, and the players will go, I listen at you described a door. I listen at the door to see if we can hear anything on the other side. And the dungeon master will roll some dice and go, ah, yes, you can hear a faint murmuring, but you don't recognize the language. And if he'd rolled higher, the player might have recognized the language as orcish. If he'd rolled lower, you wouldn't have heard anything at all. And the players then make a decision based on that information. The dungeon master reacts to that, and it continues.
Mm-hmm.
As I've said, can continue for decades.
Yes,
it's an open-ended game.
Yeah, thank you.
So it's like a soap opera.
So you're going to talk about like getting involved in writing and fanzines.
Yes, so I started fanzines, amateur publications put together with print runs of 50 or 100, and I saw one of these, and without attempting to write for anyone else, I mean, I was writing for recreation, just for my own amusement. I decided to do one and started up a horrible little fanzine called Weir Man. I'm actually on a crusade to track down and destroy all remaining copies. It's so embarrassingly bad. I mean, Juvenile Ephemera doesn't begin to cover it. I was 15 and just coming up with the worst, most hackneyed and cliched ideas. I had no idea they were cliches, but they were. But it taught me an awful lot about writing for print and publishing and all the rest of that. And I got bitten by the bug. So left school, went to university, started another fanzine called Sound and Fury, which made a bit of a splash.
What were you studying?
I was studying modern English, okay. Which was basically it was a literature degree with a fair amount of English and American literature. Mm-hmm. I decided quite early on I didn't want to take a year to study to learn Old English and study Beowulf and Chaucer. My interests were more modern, and at that point I thought I was going to go either into advertising or journalism. Mm. But I did this fanzine and realised pretty quickly that actually I could be paid by magazines like White Dwarf, which at the time was the number one British games magazine. They would pay me for the same kind of material that I was paying to publish in the fanzine. Fanzines do not make money. Hmm. They're cash sinks. They're a hobby, essentially. So I started writing for White Dwarf. I paid my bar bills through college through that. Continued with the fanzine. And then I left in summer of 89, went off around the world and found myself at Gen Con, the preeminent American games tabletop games convention, which at the time was about 20,000-25,000 people over a weekend, which back then was a big deal. I think it's 60,000 now.
It's become huge, isn't it?
It's massive.
Apparently it's growing like by more than 20% every year, and the hobby market is growing as well, which I mean, we'll come back to that because I want to talk about it.
Yeah, no, the tabletop market's on a massive boom at the moment. But I was staying with a friend who I'd met through doing the fanzine. He'd subscribed to the fanzine. He was a professional games designer. He introduced me to one of his publishers, and they went, oh, we're doing a book set in England, and the writer's just dropped off it. Do you want it? I was, okay, why not? I don't really have much else to do at the moment. I might as well write a games book. And that was that. I did a couple. That was a company called Palladium. I did a couple of books for them. Continued with the journalism. So I never really planned to be a games designer. It was never my end goal. But I kind of fell into it. And the work kept coming. I did some postgraduate work in journalism. I spent most of the 90s simultaneously running Hogshead Publishing, which I've mentioned, and working a day job on magazines. Mm. I was part of the launch team of a magazine called Bizarre, which was kind of counterculture and weird society stuff, and did very well. I was managing editor for its first 2 years, took it to a circulation of over 100,000 and quit. I spent some time on the Sunday Times, which was fantastic. Real education. Mm. But at the same time running this company, this games publishing company in evenings and weekends.
Yeah.
And sometimes writing books for other people too.
It seems to be that most of the people, John Wick told me that, he worked in journalism as well, and studying journalism, writing, and working for a magazine was some of the stuff that was the best training for writing games later on.
Absolutely.
And ultimately, most of the role-playing games, the format is essentially a book, right?
Mm.
So I wonder what comes first. I mean, the writing, it's automatic to be interested in writing, it seems like, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so. But it's a particular format of writing. It's quite constrained. Because you need to create rules. You need to... essentially, you're creating a... To write a role-playing game, you're creating a fictional world in which other people will have adventures. And sometimes you will create the adventures as well. But having set up the rules, you're not really allowed to break them. Mm. So you set up... And then you need to come up with a literal set of rules, of tables and charts and formulae by which this world will work, by which other people will be able to interact with the world. So a combat system, for example, if a group of players get into combat either with each other or with enemies controlled by the games master, you need a very rigid set of rules to establish who's going to win that. There are games that attempt to do it just in narrative, just with storytelling in a very loosey-goosey way. They're unsatisfying because at the end of a combat, you always almost inevitably feel that it's been too easy or too hard because the GM in most games has ultimate fiat and can basically say this succeeds, this fails. Without the rules, it's just down to what the GM wants to happen. And, you know, for some groups that's fine, but for most people, they want to feel that the world is balanced. They want to feel that it's fair.
Mm.
They don't necessarily need to feel that it's realistic, but they have to believe in it. Because if you don't believe in it, then you're why are you playing this game? Why are you inhabiting this world at all? And in order to believe in it, it needs to have some sense of objectivity. It's not just under the control of the game's master. It needs to have kind of an existence of its own. And that's what a rule set will give it.
Interesting. So you were at Hogshead, you had Hogshead Publishing, and then mm-hmm. after that?
I sold Hogshead in 2000. I can never remember if it was 2002 or 2003. And I took a little while off.
Mm-hmm.
The games industry was in a really interesting point at that point. Dungeons & Dragons was being published by Wizards of the Coast, who had acquired TSR. Wizards of the Coast created Magic the Gathering, and yes. basically the collectible card game craze, which was massive for most of the 90s and the early yes. 2000s. They also did the Pokemon card game, which was bigger than Magic. So they were very cash rich. They bought TSR and took over Dungeons & Dragons. TSR was functionally bankrupt. It wasn't actually bankrupt, but it had no operating, it couldn't afford to operate anymore. And then in turn, Wizards had been bought out by Hasbro, largest toy company yeah. in the world. So Hasbro was controlling Dungeons & Dragons. And they took a very bold step with the third edition of Dungeons & Dragons. They open sourced the mechanics. They released it under what they call the Open Gaming License, the OGL, essentially saying that anyone could take these mechanics and publish their own material for it and for them and include these mechanics within the game. They couldn't publish stuff, they couldn't claim that the stuff was authorized for Dungeons and Dragons, but they could say it was authorized for use with D20 systems, D20 being the name for the mechanics that powered Dungeons and Dragons 3rd edition. And there was a gold rush, followed swiftly thereafter by a glut, and the shape of the market changed very quickly. It used to be the good product would have a shelf life of years, whether a rule system or a supplement for it. But there was so much D20 product being released to the market of such variable quality that the shelf life of pretty much all games products was measured in weeks.
Yeah.
So Hogshead was based on the idea of really putting time and love and effort into producing the best book we possibly could, the best games we possibly could. And we won design awards for layout, for production.
Mm.
And suddenly, you know, you release a product like that to the market, and after 2 months it stops selling. You can't make money on that.
Yeah.
So I went, okay, the market is somewhere I don't want to be. I don't want to change the company to fit this new model because I'm not prepared to just churn crap out. That's not why I'm not in the industry. I'm in here in the industry to do my best work. Heaven knows there's little enough money in it as it is. I want to at least be satisfied with the product we're putting out. And I didn't see it changing back anytime soon. So I sold the company and went off and did other stuff. I did some dot-comming. I presented some TV shows on the early days of digital TV. Nobody watched them. Nobody had a digital TV. But it was a fantastic experience. I wrote some books. And then I got lured back I don't know exactly when, actually. About 2007, I went back into... I'd always kept coming back to games. Games are what I love, and I think it's what I'm good at.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's where I have a reputation. I look at things. I look at culture, and I see it in terms of games. That's my filter, my lens for how I appreciate the world. You know, a painter will look at a scene and think, how will I paint this? I look at a situation and go, how will I turn this into a game? Or quite often, the game will just pop into my head. And I kept coming back to this as, well, I might as well make it my livelihood. So I've been consulting pretty much since then and teaching as well.
I think I met you for the first time at the first Playful conference event.
Yes.
And I think you just started your consultancy at that time, more or less.
Yes.
And you spoke at that conference, right?
I did, yes. Yeah. It's the consultancy is called Space with 3 A's. We're a AAA company. Yes, it's been going 7 or 8 years now. And we design games for commercial release. We design games for other people. We talk to them about using games as part of branding or customer engagement or internal training, team building, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
We simply teach people how to design better games. And the client list is really interesting. It's from hobbyists with a design that they want to take forward up to... A couple of years ago, I was working for Shell and Greenpeace simultaneously on different projects, which did my head in a bit. that was entertaining. A very, very different project. I've done some work for Carlsberg. I've just finished some stuff for a major credit rating agency, designing a card game for them.
Really?
Bizarrely, for internal training. Not simply training people new skills, but new ways of thinking about yes. problems, which is very, very easy to model with a card game.
Yeah. I was just going to say I'm really interested in games. It's part of the reason that we're having this conversation, of course.
Yeah.
And I was having this conversation with John as well about, we all learn through playing, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And which is one of the reasons we have games. And it's great that you're talking about how to design something. But I wonder, these kinds of projects, how do they come up? Because I think corporations, maybe it's something they think about a little bit more, but it's not usually the first thing somebody would think of, like that we need to... What comes up is, well, I'd like all these people to learn this stuff, but turning that into, well, the game is a game, what might be the good solution? How does that come around?
I'm in an amazingly fortunate position that people tend to come to me rather than me having to go to them.
Mm.
I get a number of interesting phone calls, let's put it that way.
Okay, cool.
And people say, we've got this project. Sometimes it's the brands themselves or the corporate clients themselves or the game designers themselves or the games company. But sometimes it's agencies going, we've got this client and they want to do this and we think it's a game, but we don't know games.
Yes.
Come and help.
Okay.
And that's great.
Yeah.
There are a number of small agencies I do regular work with.
Cool.
It's fantastic fun. They're great people. Mm. Creatively, it's very fulfilling. And I think we do some good work as well. I think, we set out to actually affect change for the better within large companies to help them function better and help them simply be better entities.
Yeah.
And it seems to be paying off.
Yeah. Do you have an approach generally to game design or the main inspirations, or does it change every time? Or
it absolutely changes every time. I can't analyze how I think about games, mm-hmm. The design patterns that my the darker parts of my mind bring up. A lot of it is just I've immersed myself in games since I was, in my early teens. My critical vocabulary for games is going to sound boastful, but it's really quite large and very, very varied as well. Mm. I don't stick to one type of game. I play everything. If someone says, I've got a game, I don't stop to ask whether it's a video game or a tabletop game, or if I'm going to find myself running around some woods clutching a spear made out of insulating foam. I will go and play it because every game I play teaches me something new, whether it's a new way of dealing with rules or a new way that people interact in particular situations.
Yes.
It's very rare to think of a game that I can't take something away from. And, I have a very large collection of games. And there have been a couple of projects, not ones that I'm terribly proud of. I won't name the client because they wouldn't like to hear it, but there was one where... The client came in and said, we need a game, we've got this problem, and we've got a massive conference that we need to solve it at, and it's in 14 days. I was like, okay, so you want us to come up with a game design? No, we want you to publish a game. So we had 14 days to go from nothing to 700 published printed copies of a card game.
That's pretty ambitious.
And I did it by basically going, the best solution to this problem is to rip off an existing game design. Or at least take their mechanics and redo all the cards, redo all the presentation and the system by which it works and the underlying ethos. But the rules are, they're not word for word identical, but beat for beat, they're identical. And this is one of the interesting things about the games industry. There is no copyright in game mechanics at all.
Mm.
Absolutely none. You can patent a game mechanic or a collection of game mechanics, but for that you have to be convinced that they are wholly original and you have to go through the patenting process, which is very long and very expensive. To my knowledge, there have only been two in the last few years that have been worth doing. Magic the Gathering in the early 90s patented the collectible card game mechanic, and the whole patent hinged on the idea of tapping a card. The idea being, once you've used a card in play, the card is in play in front of you. Rather than discarding it, you simply turn it through 90 degrees to show that it has been used that turn. It sounds incredibly simple, but nobody had done that before, and they were able to get a patent on it. The patent was never tested in court, but they did threaten a number of other companies who had simply used that mechanic without attributing it and got licenses from them. The other one is a company called WizKids, which was subsequently bought out by Topps, the collectible card manufacturer. WizKids did a number of games based on pre-painted miniature figures that would fight each other. And the first ones that were called Mage Knight, and they were fantasy figures, and then they did BattleTech, which was giant robots, partly, and they were able to do that because Jordan Wiseman, who set up WizKids, had also previously set up Fazer, who created BattleTech. Jordan is just one of the great brains of the games industry. He's impossible. Impossible is the wrong word. It is impossible for him to have an idea without it being potentially worth millions of dollars. He's so good. So anyway, so they did a bunch of this stuff. But the idea was, the way the miniatures fought is they had round bases mm-hmm. with wheels inside them and little windows through which you could see the numbers printed on the wheels. And as the combat went on, you turned the wheel to show as your figure was damaged, was hurt, or their combat powers increased or decreased. They got a patent on that and, again, were able to successfully license it and make a bunch of money on it. Those are the only two I'm aware of that have been worth doing.
Mm.
I will occasionally get emails from inventors going, I've invented a board game and I've patented it. And then they send me a copy of the board game and it's a reskin of Monopoly. It's right. Like, okay, well, this patent is not going to stand up. This is, you know, you've got nothing original here. But yeah, so there's no copyright in game mechanics.
That's and what interesting.
This has led to is an ethos within role-playing games, but also within board games, that we grow by standing on each other's shoulders.
Mm.
It is okay to borrow each other's mechanics. It's not okay to rip them off wholesale, as I did for this client project, but we, you know, I knew that was only going to be a few hundred copies of a game. It was a one-off thing. It would never be seen again. And I hated myself for doing it, but sometimes 14 days. It was, you know, and it came out really well. I think actually we improved on the original game. I think we got the card, our card mix was better. But, where was I going? Yeah, so.
Do you think, sorry, and yep. It seems like the industry, from what you're saying, seems to be pretty collaborative. And do you think it's because a lot of games are collaborative, and so the way that you're playing together also informs the way that you're designing together, that informs the industry a little bit?
I think so, yes. I mean, there's a shared vocabulary, obviously, of game mechanics. The analogy I use a lot, I run game design workshops mm-hmm. to teach people how to design games, how to think about game design. But it's also as a metaphor for rapid prototyping, for swift iteration, UI, UX stuff and team building, all the rest of that. But the metaphor I use during that is recipes.
Mm-hmm.
There are, it seems like, an infinite number of recipes that derive from a finite number of ingredients. And if you, each one of those ingredients you think of as a game mechanic, games work the same way. There are a finite number of game mechanics. I think Board Game Geek, the preeminent website for this stuff, has a list of about 50 core game mechanics. And pretty much every game that comes out is a mix and match of ways to use those mechanics. Every so often, someone comes up with a new ingredient, and that's where the big money is. Right. And that's the collectible card mechanic. That's the clicky base on the Hero Clicks figures. That's the deck-building mechanic that powers a Dominion, a massively influential game that came out a few years ago. It won the Spiel des Jahres. And the idea of that is you start off with a very small number of cards, and you're attempting to create this customized deck of cards as the game goes on. The idea of deck building is not new. It actually comes from Magic the Gathering, from the collectible card games. But there you customize your deck of cards before the game starts. Yes. In Dominion, the game is creating the deck of cards and optimizing the deck of cards.
Okay.
It's a lovely game. I recommend it very, very highly.
I've heard of it, but I've not tried it, actually. And
It's just one of those. You play it once and you just go, oh, I could spend the whole weekend doing this. It's just, there's so much richness and so much variety and depth in the game. It's really very, very clever.
How about, can you walk us through like a couple of your, well, the famous and awarded games that you've designed? So Once Upon a Time?
Mm-hmm.
Would you start there? Would you start with another one?
I would start with Once Upon a Time.
Okay.
Once Upon a Time, which I designed with Andrew Rilston and Richard Lambert. It came out in 1993. It's it kind of half introduces a new ingredient, a new mechanic. Okay. It's a narrative card game. It is a game that is explicitly about telling stories. It describes itself as a storytelling card game. The group, as a group of players, you each get a hand of cards with archetypes from fairy tales, Western fairy tales on them. So, which fall into one of five groups. There are aspects, characters, events, places, and things. So it'll be a princess, a castle, a sword, two people fall in love, and very ugly. And you get a bunch of these in a mix, but they're also interrupt cards. So, and everyone gets an ending. So you all tell the same story. One person starts off, once upon a time, there was a mighty castle on top of a hill in which it lived a princess. And she was a princess. She was very ugly because when she'd been a tiny baby, she'd been cursed. Well, you over on the other side of the table, you've got the cursed card. Because it's fairy tales, because it's dealing with a restricted vocabulary, the vocabulary of the genre, there's a finite number of archetypes. You've got the cursed card. You can interrupt me by simply jumping in and going, you said cursed. You put the card out. You take over the story at that point, but now using the cards in your hand, trying to steer it round to your ending. Everyone has a different ending card. You can't play your ending until you've played all the rest of the cards in your hand. And that's basically the game. It doesn't sound terribly sophisticated, and it's not a terribly strategic game. There are strategies. I've had long conversations with people who say there are no strategies. There are strategies. They're just not conventional game strategies.
They're persuasion strategies.
Absolutely. A lot of it is social engineering.
Yeah.
And persuading people to introduce things into the story without realizing they're doing it.
Yeah. And one other important mechanic is to never contradict anything that was previously said so that you have a flow.
Absolutely. If it's been said, it stands. You can later, my story could be one day a knight rode up to the gates of the castle and killed the princess and then go off on it. But you can't say that something just didn't previously exist. And this, we actually, once upon a time, launched at the same summer as Magic the Gathering. So it didn't get an awful lot of attention. But it has been in print pretty much consistently since 1993. We've done about 250,000 copies now. It's got a whole bunch of expansion sets. So the basic game is generic fairy tales. Mm-hmm. And then there's enchanting tales, which is princesses and fairies. There's knightly tales, which is chivalric stuff. There's swashbuckling tales, or it's seafaring tales, which is pirates and buccaneers. Coming out shortly, there's animal tales, which is the kind of more Aesopian, that kind of end of things. There's a set of blank cards you can get for it. There's even a book about how to use it as a tool for creative writing. And it's been picked up by the creative writing community a good deal, but it's also used an awful lot to teach English and literary skills. And because it's out in, I don't actually know how many languages the third edition is out in. I know it's about to come out in Hebrew, which is a first, and I think it's just out in Russian. And there's a Chinese edition and a pirated Chinese edition. You know you've succeeded when people are pirating your board games. So it's also used to teach similar skills in other languages as well. And it's enormously gratifying. And people have run with this idea of games that tell stories, or games that where stories are bound up within the narrative of the game in an explicit way. It's always been implicit within games. Chess creates a narrative. It's not a great narrative, but there is a narrative there. If you anthropomorphize the chess pieces, if you think of pawns as foot soldiers, if you think of the king and the queen literally as a king and a queen rather than as different shaped pieces, then the battle that plays out in front of you is a narrative.
There's one point. So obviously work in the marketing and advertising industry, which you've worked a little bit in as well.
I have, yes.
There's a huge amount, like increasingly, and right now is super popular. The word storytelling is all over the place. It's like one of the buzzwords that has just been going around. What do you think of the buzzword and the way that it's being used at the moment?
Oh, I think it's monstrously misused. Because I think when storytelling, it sounds lovely. It conjures up so many wonderful images of sitting around the fire or, darkened room as old libraries, people telling each other ghost stories around campfires, that kind of thing. What they're actually talking about is narrative. A narrative is simply a sequence of events, but a story specifically has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm. Though, as Goddard said, not necessarily in that order. So, a story is a different thing, and creating a story, an interesting story that people are going to want to absorb as a story, and potentially transmit and retell or mess around with is a very difficult thing. And we were lucky with Once Upon a Time that we lucked into the fairy tale genre as a start point. And that wasn't me, that was Andrew and Richard. I was the third designer, as in I came in third in the sequence. I polished it and sold it, basically, but the core ideas were theirs. But I then spent 15 years trying to come up with a ghost story version of the same thing. Ghost stories are incredibly fragile. They are incredibly specific in what they have to do, whereas fairy tales are amazingly robust, and you can slam them around, swap characters in and out, rearrange everything, and they'll still work as a story. And I have still to this day not been able to get that ghost story game to work. I've got a gothic horror game which works reasonably well, telling gothic horror stories. But I can't do ghost stories, which is a shame because narratively, in terms of writing fiction, ghost stories are my great love.
Okay.
And I write fiction as well. So I'm aware of narrative on both sides of the fence. And narrative games are what I want to make work. If my life's ambition is to do the best narrative games of all time. So Once Upon a Time led on to the other game for which I'm really well known, which is The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen, based on the 18th century book The Travels and Surprising Adventures of Baron Munchausen by Rudolf Erich Rasp, subsequently filmed many times by a number of directors, most notably Terry Gilliam. This Munchausen, he was a real historical figure. He was a German soldier and nobleman. He was renowned for his larger-than-life after-dinner tales. Rasp was an itinerant librarian and described by his biographer as a rogue. He would go and catalogue someone's library, steal all the best bits, and leave and before the crime was discovered. And he did this repeatedly. Finally, Germany got too hot for him and he fled to England, where, among other books, he was also a brilliant metallurgist. But among other books, he wrote The Travels and Surprising Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which became a classic. He'd never met Munchausen, and he just made these stories up. And they are larger-than-life after-dinner tales. The Baron will tell a story about, how he accidentally gets kidnapped by a flock of swans. I can't remember. It's been a while since I read them. Flock of swans rise up, take him up into the sky, and he flies to the sun, where he meets the king of the sun, who's engaged in a war with someone else, and mighty asparagus spears, and people who carry their heads under their arms. And it's just bonkers. It's brilliantly surreal, bonkers stuff. And charming, and he's such a personality. His personality just shines through this the book. And I've been trying for a couple of years to do a traditional GM and players based role playing game based on these stories, and it hadn't worked, and it hadn't worked, and it hadn't worked, until I was literally in the shower one morning and thinking about, well, why isn't it working? Well, it's because these stories never happen. They're only ever told over a drink. So what it needs to be is a game about telling stories over a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, it leapt fully formed into my head. I had the entire game. And the game that was published is pretty much the game as it appeared in my head, which is remarkable. Normally, when you create a game, you will spend most of your time playtesting it. Just playtesting, refining and polishing, and refining and polishing over and over and over again. And when I started my career as a consultant, because I did my first bits of consultancy in the early 2000s, shortly after selling Hogshead, there were a lot of digital agencies who had done a lot of websites and had been approached to do games. We're going, well, it's going to be like doing a website, isn't it?
Yes.
And would put together the version of the game and go, oh, this isn't very good, but we only have a week left to deliver and no budget left. And would call me in and go, well, how do we fix that? And the answer is, well, you take another 3 months.
Yeah.
Because that's it. There's no other way to do it. There are no magic formula for creating a good game. You just have to refine and polish and refine and polish. And even with my experience in the games industry, sometimes a game will leap fully fledged into my head and I'll go, this is brilliant, and it will require no playtesting and it'll just be great. And Munchausen, it did get a lot of playtesting, but was essentially the game that's published is the game I came up with. There's another one I came up with a few years ago called Gods and Men, and I looked at this on paper and went, I'm going to win awards for this. And I playtested it at a little event in Norway, and it stank on the table like dead fish. There was no game there. It did not work in any respect. None of it worked. It was horrible. it was genuinely a crushing experience because I thought this was a brilliant game design. I thought it was new and radical and clever and everything was going to hang together and it would just be good. And it wasn't. So even at this stage of my career, I can't tell. I can't tell on paper whether a game is going to be good or bad, which is one of the reasons I don't review games anymore.
You got to play it. Sorry, you just tracking back. Munchausen, the mechanic is you're telling a story around the table.
It's competitive boasting, basically.
Yes.
A group of players. It's interesting. It's derived from Once Upon a Time, but it's also derived from traditional role-playing games. You are playing a role, but there is no games master. There is no referee. You're simply all playing 18th century drunk noblemen or women around a table in an inn or a club or something, challenging each other to tell stories of your amazing exploits. So I would turn to you and say, my dear Count Willem, I haven't seen you in years, and I've heard so much of your exploits in the intervening time. The story I am most intrigued by, pray tell us of the time you accidentally impregnated the Pope. And you just have to start telling this story. Just with no prep, you've got a drink in front of you, so you can take 5 seconds or so to have a swig of your drink, but you just have to launch into telling this story, which should last about 5 minutes or so. But the other players, and there's a little bidding mechanic involving coins, other players can interrupt you and can throw objections and corrections at you. And, you say you were in Vienna in the spring, but it's well known Vienna closes for spring cleaning. How could you possibly have got in? And you can either accept this objection and the coin that's been proffered to you and go, of course you're right. How foolish of me to have forgotten that. And you must then justify it. Or alternatively, you can go, well, yes, but this was the summer of 17, this was the spring of 17 blank blank, when, as you know, they opened the city specially for the May Day parades. And it was, you know, so you push the coin back with one of your own. And, you know, so it progresses like that. It sounds like that's going to make it harder. Actually, it doesn't. It gives you handholds that you can choose to accept or reject for climbing up the cliff face of this story. And what it means, because you're just making crap up in a world that's in a game that's about making crap up, people come up with the wildest ideas. When you allow it to, your subconscious mind can come up with the most brilliant, extraordinary stuff. And most of the time, we spend a lot of our education having creativity hammered out of us.
Yes.
Being told that creativity was not a fruitful thing, or when it was fruitful, it should be constrained and channeled and focused. And there were the right ways and wrong ways of doing it. Mm. We are brilliantly creative individuals, all of us, when we allow ourselves to be. And Munchausen is essentially a tool for letting some of that out. And it's very funny. I know
it's good. It's one of my favorite activities usually to talk and make up complete crap with my friends generally. So that's one of the reasons why I like that kind of game, because it just, you know, puts a bit of formula and it gives permission.
Yes, it gives permission. That's very important.
Yeah.
And a little bit of structure as well. It says what you can and you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
The rules are actually, it's half a page of rules. It's a very, very short game. You can't sell half a page of rules.
But that's the other interesting thing. From a business perspective, these kinds of games, because you're packaging, what, like some coins and a half a page of rules.
Yeah, well, it's a book, like so many of these tabletop games. It's a book because, this is going to sound bizarre, I discovered, not long before I published Munchausen, after I'd been a professional game designer being paid to write about games for more than 10 years, I discovered that my ancestors, John and Edward Wallace, at the end of the 17th, no, yes, but end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, were board game publishers in London. Seriously, John and Edward Wallace and John Jr. Came up with very, very dull games by traditional standards. Just track games with numbered tracks, and you move counters around. It wasn't dice, because dice were associated with gambling. You would spin a teetotum, which does exactly the same thing. It generates a number from 1 to 6, but it's not a dice. And they produced the variants on the game of the goose, the traditional Italian game, but also the tours around England and Wales, which are kind of you follow a numbered track and end up in numbered locations. Right. And the educational thing tells you what's produced in Hull, what each location you're in is notable for. And then there were games to teach morality. Again, you spin the thing and move, and it's like, okay, oh, well, I'm on this particular space of that represents this period of life, and here are the pitfalls and whatever. No subtlety to them at all, but beautiful engraved boards. Originals go for thousands of pounds these days. I don't own any originals. But as the story goes, I'm going through the family papers, and I discover this manuscript, this envelope with John Senior's handwriting on it. Turns out to be the manuscript of a game that he has commissioned from Baron Munchausen, who he met at the end of the 18th century as the Baron was passing through Dover. John invites him to stay with him in London and commissions a game from the Baron based on his extraordinary exploits. Written down, the Baron basically narrates, and Edward writes down the manuscript. And John gets this thing the following morning, his cellar having been drunk dry in the interim, realizes that there is no way the games market of that time will take such a thing. But packages it, hides it away in the family papers until such times it might be ready to bring to market. 2 centuries later, to the year, I find this thing, and it just so happens I've been thinking about a game about Baron Munchausen, and there you go. I leave it to you to decide at what point that anecdote ceases to be true. It starts off completely true, and it ends up being the most arrant nonsense. But I have had emails from PhD students going, I understand you have access to the papers of John and Edward Wallace, games designers. Can you let me see them? It's like, there are no papers. There are no papers. It's a game about making stuff up. And that's the forward of the game, basically.
And that's one of the great things that John repeats, and John Wake, who I interviewed, I mentioned earlier, and I love the thing that he said, and he says regularly, and you probably heard him say, that the more he does game design workshops and designs more games, he's like, well, one of these days, all the people that are a fan of games are going to realize that we're just making this shit up.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a... In terms of raw creativity, I've not done anything professionally to touch it, and as I say, I've written books, I've done film marketing, I've written scripts. Game design is just, in terms of the density of ideas per page, I don't think there's anything to touch it. There's such richness there. Mm.
Brilliant. So that was Munchausen. Where mm-hmm. would you go next after that in terms of major games? Did you go to Kickstarter, or is there anything in between?
Probably Kickstarter. I mean, I've been involved in an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah, sure.
But actually, in terms of games that I have published with my name on the cover,
yeah. There
aren't that many of them. There's an awful lot of games where I've assisted, or I get a publisher credit or an editor credit.
Yes.
Some of which I can talk about, some of which I can't. But I would probably move because we're not going to be here all day.
No, exactly. That's why. And plus, like Kickstarter and what's going on now and how it's changed the games industry is a big topic. And I know you participated in a few different successful Kickstarters and actually told people about how to do successful Kickstarters.
That's now a substantial part of my consultancy, telling people what to do and what not to do in Kickstarter and crowdfunding campaigns.
So how did you start on Kickstarter? Did you find out about crowdfunding first, or did you have the game in mind first? Or
I've been following the crowdfunding model for some time, which the games industry have been doing bits of that kind of thing for some time. We referred to it as the ransom model, and the idea was a well-known creator or a known creator would contact their fan base through the internet. All of this is possible because of the internet.
Yeah.
And say, I have this project. If you collectively can pledge this much money, I will write it or I will release it. In some cases, it was stuff that they'd written already.
So the idea of patronage is
exactly it's going back to the 18th century. It's the model that created Johnson's Dictionary and Pope's translation of Homer.
Yeah.
It's actually a very, very old publishing model. But reinvented for the modern age, and that's all Kickstarter is. Just Kickstarter allows you to go to a much, much wider audience and take payment from them much more successfully. So that had been going on. I can't think when Greg Stolze did the first ones, but did his first ones, and Monty Cook as well did similar ones probably about 10 years ago. So this is pre-Kickstarter. And then Kickstarter comes along and everyone just gravitates to it because it's a brilliant platform. And in fact, the guy who runs Kickstarter's games section, which is one of their largest sections, is Luke Crane, who's a really well-known tabletop games designer in his own right, doing the same kind of thing I was doing in the late 1990s. His day job is Kickstarter. His evening job is making and publishing games. So they're a very sympathetic ear for the games market. But the games as a market, particularly role-playing games, have become very fragmented. Mm. When I got into the industry, you could sell 5,000... When I started Hogshead, you could sell 5,000 copies of a rule book, as long as you knew what you were doing, as long as you didn't just concentrate on the UK market or something stupid like that. 5,000 copies was a pretty good run for a core rule book. By the time I got out in 2002, it was down to 2,000.
There had been a huge dip at that point.
Huge dip.
Was it related to the D20?
Partly the D20 thing, partly also the barriers to entry coming down. Print on demand was in its nascency then, but you could still... Lower print runs were becoming affordable. PDF was around. People were beginning to sell. Again, this is an area that role-playing games pioneered. The selling of the e-books.
Yeah.
People were selling e-books as stores, not as publishers, but as retail online stores from, to my knowledge, about 97 or 98 onwards. Mm. So it's not pre-Amazon, but it's pre-Amazon doing anything with e-books.
Yeah.
So anyone could do that. And very quickly, companies set up that would take anyone's PDFs or EPUBs or whatever format it was and publish them and sell them for you online.
Massively rope, like video games as well? Do you think that had an influence? Or is it separate?
I think separate. Okay. And this is pre-platforms like Steam, which is now the preeminent platform for PC video gaming. It's the storefront. It's the engine that drives the retail end of the games, but I think they were to a large extent inspired by what was going on with ebooks.
Okay.
And quite possibly, I don't know, I should talk to them, but a lot of this role playing game kind of pioneered this stuff. It used to be in the very early days of the web that if you did a web search for anything, you'd get your 10 results on the first page. At least one of them would be somebody's role-playing game website. The density of role-playing games websites in the early days of the web was extraordinary. And that's died away now. But there's always been this push to early adoption within the field. So the sales of the traditional sales of tabletop role-play were dying away. And this was partly because of the business model. Mm. It's been very retailer-driven. So the publisher would sell their books to a distributor. The distributor would sell to a retailer. The retailer would send to the end customer. The publisher has almost no contact with that end customer. This is still 2002. You know, there are bulletin boards, there are mailing lists, but no one really knows how to do social media. 2002, there are no social networks. Friendster is just starting. I can date the start of Friendster exactly because I met my wife on Friendster. And Friendster was not very old at that point. So I forgot where I was going with this. Give me a second to get back on track. Yes, so that traditional model of having to buy your books either from a retailer or at a games show or a convention or from somewhere like Amazon where there simply isn't that much information about them. Still difficult at this point for publishers to set up their own e-commerce stores. Yeah. And then Kickstarter comes along and says, look, you can contact your audience directly, or your potential audience. You can contact them directly. And one of the interesting things about Kickstarter, and one of the primary mistakes that people make when setting up a crowdfunding campaign, mm-hmm. Kickstarter will not bring you an audience.
Yes.
A lot of people I've talked to assume that if you just put up a page on Kickstarter, people will come to it. Actually, if you look at Kickstarter, if you type in your geographic location, just to kind of narrow the field a bit, and then just flip through the pages, by the time you've gone through about eight or nine pages of the campaigns that are running in your area. You will very quickly start hitting campaigns, well put together pages for interesting projects with literally no pledges at all. Mm-hmm. Nobody has pledged money to this. And largely that's because nobody has seen it.
Yeah.
Nobody has seen the campaign page. And some people just massively mismanage their campaigns. I've spoken to people who launched their page at 2 in the morning with no fanfare at all. If you start at 2 in the morning, it's going to finish at 2 in the morning and nobody will be watching. The time you make the most money on a Kickstarter campaign are in the 6 hours after it's launched and the 6 hours before it's finished. So really? Don't launch your thing at... the model I usually give people, the rule of thumb, is you'll make a third of your money in the first 5 to 6 days,
mm-hmm.
a third of your money in the final 5 to 6 days, and then the other third in the lull period between those two dates. And it doesn't matter how long your campaign runs for, it'll still be more or less a third in the middle bit.
Mm.
And as it drops, and it drops off really quite dramatically after the opening, and everyone thinks, oh, we've done something catastrophically wrong, the whole thing's just a disaster, and then it bumps along the bottom for a few weeks and then it picks up again towards the end. It's a very standard curve. There's a few projects that buck that, but by and large that's the way it goes.
Did you study all of this before you launched your first campaign?
I did. Yeah. I have the advantage of sharing an office, as I said, with Pelgrane Press, who had run two very successful six-figure Kickstarters for role-playing games. Games that they had thought would make maybe $5,000 or $6,000, and which very quickly went up north of $100,000. And so I tapped their expertise. But I looked at an awful lot. I looked at Kickstarter. I looked at Indiegogo and all the others. And analytics sites. There's a site called KickTrack, T-R-A-Q at the end, which basically analyzes how Kickstarters go and record every single Kickstarter campaign that has been run. So you can track day by day how many pledges are coming in, what your curves look like. They've got a very simple prediction engine that attempts to predict how much money you're going to make. It is wrong. It is always, always wrong. But apart from that, in just in terms of data gathering, it's absolutely invaluable.
Mm.
So anyone planning any kind of campaign should go and look at similar campaigns on KickTrack, see what they did, see how their totals broke down, where the spikes were, what caused the spikes.
Do they have anything like a rule of thumb or some kind of estimate between the size of your audience or the size of the audience that you should have and how much money you might be able to raise? I mean, I don't think there's anything like it, but
no,
if there was, it would be great.
I've not come across anything. I've not seen anyone be prepared to stick their neck out enough to go, well, you know, you can break it down with, you know, the size of the name that's involved as the primary creative and the size of the project and the stretch goals and everything else. Some projects catch fire, some simply don't.
Yeah.
It's hard to know. A well-run campaign can go massively. There's a little company, formerly little company in Texas, Reaper Miniatures, who used to do, you know, traditional metal miniatures, 25mm, 28mm miniatures for war games. And they wanted to convert a bunch of their molds from metal molds, which are silicon rubber, to molds for making plastic figures, which are iron. Not iron, and some alloy, but metal anyway. So it is very expensive to create metal molds. But at the same time, once you've made them, your cost per miniature drops almost exponentially. Once you've paid for the cost of the molds, because the cost of a plastic miniature, you're just paying for the plastic, and it's much faster to make them as well. Whereas metal miniatures, you've got to wait for the metal to cool, all the rest of that. It's much more haphazard. Plus, the metal can bend and fragment. So they launched a campaign going, well, we'll do some of, we want a campaign. Oops. I'm sorry, I'm completely losing it. Edit this bit out. Just to let me regather myself. So they launched a Kickstarter saying we want to convert the molds for some of our core figures, some of the most popular ones, and we'll only do one batch. And they put in their reward levels. On Kickstarter, you can start off with it's the amount of money that people can pledge to the campaign and what they get for pledging at different levels. And there's always a $1 level, which is a kind of a thank you thing, and there should always be one at the top level, which is $10,000 or £5,000. This is basic. Dan Ariely's book, Predictably Irrational.
Yeah.
Everybody who does a Kickstarter should read Predictably Irrational first, because it will teach you how to structure your reward levels.
Yeah.
So you put the 5,000 one up. Nobody is going to bid £5,000 for your top reward, but it makes everything else look cheaper. What Reaper did was they put a reward at, I think, $100, and they said, for $100, you will get this many miniatures. But if we exceed our funding target, we will introduce stretch goals. For every extra, I forget what it was, $20,000, we'll do another set of metal molds. And if you pledge at $100, we will include a set of miniatures made from this additional mold. Mm. So very quickly, it became apparent that this was a good deal. I mean, just at the basic $100 level, this was, you were still getting a lot of miniatures for your buck. So the campaign did well. And then they started hitting the stretch goals and unlocking the stretch goals. And very quickly, the $100 level became an amazingly good deal.
Mm.
They made $4.2 million on their initial Kickstarter. And if you had pledged at the $100 level, I think you got $650 worth of miniatures.
Wow.
As your reward. It's not costing Reaper $650. It's costing, I think they're paying more in shipping than they're paying in manufacturing, because that's the economics of plastic miniatures. But they have subsequently run a whole bunch of Kickstarters based on similar campaigns. And now if you're doing a miniatures-based Kickstarter, that's the model you follow. So it's possible, if you construct it well, if you put the proper amount of thought in, you can create a campaign that will snowball under its own weight.
Do you think also Kickstarter and the model allowed more people to get introduced to the hobby games market? Because that's one of the things I was wondering about, is whether the number of people playing role-playing games, or, well, role-playing games, I think, because that's what I know the best, but has been stagnating, because considered as a, you know, small little thing. Plus, from a business perspective, once you buy one book, you can play forever with like six people. You don't need to buy more products, really.
Absolutely.
So you tend to like play with your friends, and you don't really necessarily share a lot of it unless you're doing a convention. But yeah, anyway, do you think more people have been introduced to the hobby games market through it?
I don't think so. I think it goes back to what I was saying about it. Kickstarter will not bring you an audience. There aren't people who just browse Kickstarter. There may be people who are wandering through Kickstarter and, you know, they're looking at other things. They're looking at interesting kitchen utensils or bike gimmicks. Mm. Bike stuff does really well on Kickstarter.
Yes.
As well as anything that claims it'll make your kids smarter. And it's possible that they could, you know, someone's looking at something like that, and then you get the recommended projects at the bottom. There might be a game there, and they might go and browse that. But I don't think it's been a major engine for introducing games. I think it's the resurgence, the surgence, if that's a word, of geek culture. Geek culture finally coming to the fore and people talking about this stuff. Yep. You've got sitcoms like Big Bang Theory, which I believe is the number one sitcom in the States, in which the characters follow traditionally geeky pursuits. You've got the rise of the comic book movie. You've got all this stuff just becoming accepted, that this is no longer a thing that outsiders and freaks do. Yeah. This is a thing that anyone can do. And part of that has been what Hasbro has done with Dungeons & Dragons. They've made it more accessible. The introductory set for Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, which came out last year, is really good. I've looked at an awful lot of introductory sets for an awful lot of role-playing games. It's been a major interest of mine, how to do that right. And I think 5th edition book is as good as the classic Dungeons & Dragons red box from the late 70s, early 80s, which is the sine qua non in terms of this kind of thing. D&D 5th edition intro set gets it right. It's a very, very easy way to start playing. And then you understand as you play it why you want more books, why you want more background, why you want more information, why just getting the three core books. And admittedly, those three core books will cost you $100. No, £100, I think. I think it's even more in dollars. You get an awful lot of bang for your buck. You get a huge amount of game. It is an open-ended game. You can continue playing that game for 20 or 30 years with those books. At the same time, you'll want more stuff. You'll want more published adventures, and the quality of the adventures that are coming out really good. For as we get older, as the market gets older, as teenagers, as a teenager, I could spend all my free time just thinking about games and writing game stuff and playing games with my friends. I'm no longer a teenager. I have two small kids and a dog and a family, and I don't have the time, so I need to buy pre-prepared material. And the market the industry has understood that and is preparing materials that are more suitable. It's just easier to get into, easier to access. Mm. The whole, it used to be, it's this back, back to barriers of entry. It used to be a hobby with pretty high barriers to entry.
Yeah.
You needed a body of knowledge before you could really start playing. Those walls have come down. It's much, much easier to get into. Also, the familiarity of people with the fantasy genre and the idea of fantasy gaming and the idea of role-playing
yes.
through computer games.
And like lately, Game of Thrones, I would say the TV show.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and then there's a Game of Thrones role-playing game, a very good one, has done very, very well. So, you know, maybe you could go and play the, you know, if you've read the novels and you watch the TV series, where do you go from there? Well, you can write fan fiction, as many people do, and the, you know, the fan fiction communities on the internet are massive. Or you can play this game with your friends. And because it's a role-playing game rather than a computer game, you can be skeevy and devious. And any plot that you can come up with, you can implement. Because that's the advantage that tabletop role-play still has over digital role-play. Digital role-play is very constrained by what the computer understands of your instructions, the very limited instruction set that you can give the computer. With tabletop, you're dealing with a human referee who, as long as they can understand what you're thinking, will tell you whether you succeed or fail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it makes for an interesting game, may help you structure it.
Yeah. Cool. So just being conscious of time, I'm going to move to the last section. I mean, this
sure.
is absolutely fascinating. I could, like, listen to you talk about things all day.
I just blather.
It's brilliant. So let's go, like, after the warming up, the last questions I got are cooling down. So
okay.
This is the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast.
Okay.
Do you like ice cream?
Who doesn't?
That's part of the reason why it's called that way.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite flavor?
I'll try anything once, and that goes for life generally. There's an old proverb that I used to use a lot. I'll try anything once, except incest and Morris dancing. I've tried Morris dancing.
Okay. So the other thing is, I've just decided quite selfishly that I would go out and interview the people in fields I'm interested in learning about. Another field I'm interested in is beer, homebrewing, craft beers. Do you like beers?
I don't drink beer.
You don't drink
beer?
I never
developed for complex medical reasons, I was teetotal for most of my 20s, and I never developed a taste for beer. I drink cider. I treat cider the way a lot of people drink beer. I take cider quite seriously.
Okay. Is there a particular cider you prefer, or
I love going
or
around
style
the
West Country.
I like the West Country, the scrumpy ciders, the individual farm produced ones. You can find some really fascinating stuff there. Yeah,
cool. Any particular reference to one area or place to visit in the West Country, perhaps?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, actually, my huge fondness, because I grew up very close to them, is Aspel cider, which is they're a commercial producer based in Suffolk, but I think of the bottled ciders, their stuff has a subtlety that is lacking from an awful lot of the others. There's just possibly because I grew up drinking it, but I think the quality of their ciders is just fantastic.
Cool. We touched very quickly upon marketing, advertising, and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any references or ads that you think are particularly great that you remember? Or that come off the top of your head that you remember, and whether it's storytelling or not, you just thought it was great advertising.
Just generally, I'm always fascinated by the Christmas campaigns in the UK. For those who don't know, the big supermarket chains in the UK have this annual battle to win Christmas by doing not necessarily the most lavish, but the most engaging ads.
Yes.
And typically their narrative, they tell a story. And the two major contenders this year, everyone thought that the John Lewis, is it Waitrose or John Lewis? It's John Lewis.
John Lewis with The Man on the Moon?
The Man on the Moon.
Yeah.
And it's
I'll put the links to all of this,
yes,
by the way.
It's a delightful short film, and it's helping a charity about, that's involved with old people who become very secluded. And the story, it's a Christmas story, and it's a story about gift giving. I don't know who has the John Lewis account, but the ads they've been doing recently are fantastic. There's a brilliant one of a small girl dancing around the house to Elton John's Tiny Dancer, which is screamingly funny. And it's actually, I'm not going to tell you what it's for. Go and watch it. Because every product that she dances past in the house and almost breaks is a John Lewis product. But it's not for John Lewis stuff. It's for something else. Brilliant, brilliant advert. And anyway, so the Man in the Moon commercial comes out and goes all over the internet. And everyone thinks, oh, well, it's going to be hard to top that. Sainsbury's have just released theirs. And it's 2 minutes, 10 seconds, I think. Animation about a beloved children character from a series of books, the Mog books.
I've not seen that yet.
Oh, it's Well, I don't imagine you grew up with the Mog books.
No.
But if you are under 50 in the UK, you grew up with the Mog books. You were aware of them as a cultural influence. And it's this fantastic writer whose name I'm completely blanking on. She also wrote The Tiger Who Came to Tea, which is not only one of the great kids' books of all time, but possibly one of the greatest works of English surrealism. And she wrote When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, which is autobiographical. It's about her and how she and her family fled the Nazis in the late 30s. She, I think, was 8 at the time. I can't remember her name, and it's really distressing me. But anyway, she wrote this long series of books about this family and their cat, Mog. And Sainsbury's have done a CG version of Mog. And it's a Mog Christmas story, and of course it's selling Sainsbury's stuff, but it's more selling Sainsbury's as an idea rather than as a range of products and greater things. And it's a brilliant short film. And of course they're tying it into in-store merchandise. You can now buy Mog dolls in Sainsbury. You could buy the book of the 2-minute film, and proceeds go to charity. And I think Sainsbury's have won Christmas this year. And it's a story. That's all it is. At no point is there a hard sell, really, in either of these ads. And I think the other supermarkets have pretty much given up, to be honest, because their offerings this year have been very, very lackluster. It's just kind of, whoa, big Christmas party. Look, you can buy Brussels sprouts from us. it's just not great. But those two ads, extraordinary and very, very fine storytelling. I was involved in film publicity. After I sold Hogshead, I went off and did film publicity for 2 or 3 years, writing movie trailers and radio and TV ads and print ads. Doing movie titles and also the kind of B-roll stuff and DVD extras like Makings Of, or I did a couple of Star Wars documentaries and got Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, nice, to actually voice them, which was fantastic. That's a career high point. And that is all about story. Writing a film trailer is really, really interesting. How much do you give away? What's the market? How there's a certain class of film, particularly those aimed at slightly older audiences, who don't want an unhappy ending. They don't want to risk going to see a film that's not going to be feel good. And for those, it's okay to give away the ending of the movie in the trailer, because that's what the audience want. They want to know that it's going to have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't actually have to give away the entire ending, but you can use shots from the ending that make it clear that this is going to be upbeat. And it's pretty obvious if you can parse a film or you parse a sequence of shots to work out what the greater narrative is going to be. You've got the entire plot of the film in a 90-second trailer. That's what some people want. Right. Other people want teasers. They want to be intrigued. They don't want to know before they go into the movie. And I think some of the recent Star Wars trailers, the early ones in particular, it's just all about atmosphere. Nothing about the narrative at all. There's more and more of the narrative stuff has come out.
I've not watched the last three. Not to like see anything of them.
But the first two trailers were just kind of sense of place, sense of wonder, sense of nostalgia as well. Very, very carefully made trailers. But have you seen the first one?
I've seen the first, like the teaser that was just a few seconds, I think.
Right, the one with they pan across the desert. Yes. And there's the crashed Imperial Star Destroyer.
Yeah.
That tells you nothing about what's going to be in the movie. But you want to see the movie because you want to understand how that Star Destroyer crashed. Why? So that's, tailor your narrative to your audience.
Yeah.
I would say, whether you're designing a game, whether you're designing a publicity campaign, a branding exercise, even a training exercise, be aware of your audience and their expectations and their needs,
mm-hmm,
and what's going to intrigue them and entice them and delight, mm-hmm, them as well.
Mm-hmm.
My two principles for story are surprise and delight. Give people something they're not expecting and make it delightful. And the other one is more awesome. More awesome! Which, once you've finished it, once you've got your final draft and you think that's perfect, go through and make it more awesome! Turn all the numbers up to 12.
Just crank it up to 12.
Just crank it up. Yeah. Just make it bigger. Just make it, make the peaks higher, the troughs lower.
Yeah.
It's a simple exercise, and it doesn't work for, you know, if you're doing a tender tale of you know, coming of age and loss, then perhaps More Awesome doesn't apply to that. But anything with a rollicking plot, and let's face it, games do tend to be rollicking plots, and they tend to be success stories as well. If it's a game, you know you are proceeding in the game if you are succeeding. And this particularly video games, but board games as well. If nobody succeeds at the end of the game, then you have lost the game, and you know you feel like a failure. So they tend to default to simplistic plots of triumph over adversity, and More Awesome just fits brilliantly for that kind of stuff.
Wow, cool. So some of your latest projects, and just finishing up, where can people find you, and are there any projects at the moment that you want to particularly talk about?
There are two things that will be out in the next few months.
Yeah,
very soon. Once Upon a Time is still out. Munchausen is. You can find the second edition on Amazon, but I would recommend not buying it because the third edition is coming out some next year, and I'm not supposed to talk about it. But the stuff I'm working on at the moment, I'm working on a personal project which is massively late, but I hope is going to be really good, called Las Vegas, which is it's a tabletop role-playing game modeled not on an open-ended soap opera kind of model, but on an HBO miniseries. So it plays out in four sessions and you're done.
Okay.
So it's a month's worth of plot. It's four, you know, you can play it in a week, you can play it, you know, play four times in a month, you're done. And the character, you put the characters away. And that lets the creator do stuff that's not necessarily a happy ending. The characters can go through some fairly grim experiences along the way. Because they know at the end of the fourth session their character arc is done. They're not going to just have to kind of pick themselves up and carry on indefinitely after that. And that's set in a kind of a mythic... It's not set in Las Vegas. It's set in a mythic version of Las Vegas with a bunch of characters who start the first session waking up in a shallow grave in the desert naked with amnesia. They have no idea.
And it's happening like a contemporary now, kind of now feeling to it?
Well, kind of, yes. Except you get to Vegas and it's kind of 60s, 70s Vegas,
Okay. Except
the geography is completely different and weird stuff happens.
Yeah.
It's influence. It's kind of if David Lynch wrote Fear and Loathing, directed Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Wow.
I'm aiming for that kind of dreamlike quality.
I like the... mishmash reference. It sounds like exciting.
I'm really, really pleased with it. And then as soon, because it was a
Kickstarter project. So when is that supposed to be released?
That was supposed to be released a year and a half ago. I'm finishing that up right now. I've open sourced the rules. That will be released within a week.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to write a couple of examples of play and get those right. Then the main game will be out before Christmas. And then I'm doing a novel based on that because I kickstarted it and the novel was one of the rewards.
Okay.
But the other thing is a revamp of a classic 80s tabletop role-playing game called Paranoia.
Yeah, which I'm very excited about. I've also participated in that project as Kickstarter as well.
Yeah.
So.
It's a dystopian future. The whole of humanity is living in an underground bunker, ruled by your friend, the computer. Because something bad happened and the computer won't tell you what because the computer may not know. The trouble is, you're way past the computer's operational limit and things have started to break down. And you are troubleshooters within this world. You find trouble and you shoot it. And you are the computer's enforcers, trying to obey its whims and missions. And the trouble is the computer, as the title suggests, is paranoid. The computer believes you are under attack from mutants and traitors and terrorists. In the 80s, it was commie mutant traitors. Unfortunately, commie is not so much of a scary threat these days. Terrorism, as we're constantly reminded, is a threat. And that's why it's in there. It's meant to be a dark game. It's meant to be close to the knuckle. It's not the slapstick in there. But it's meant to be a commentary. It's what I think the first and possibly the only truly satiric role-playing game. Because it's about... a society where you're universally observed by powers you don't understand. Your every move is monitored. But the big question for us was bringing it up to date, because this came out in 1984 originally, an apposite year for it. And, you know, it's the idea that, oh my goodness, there's a CCTV camera on every corner. It's like, well, what's scary about that these days? And your every communication is monitored. Not much scary about that either. That's just everyday life these days. So we've had to update it. We've had to make it dark again. And we've introduced a bunch of changes, which we're really pleased with. We've changed the mechanics to something much more contemporary and faster, and it gives the players more control of the narrative. But the characters themselves now have what we call the cerebral cortex. Everyone has an implant in their skull, which gives you a little heads-up field of vision. So you've got GPS in your eyeball, essentially, and you look at someone and it immediately reminds you of their name and how you know them and all the rest of that. Fantastic! Except that the way it does this is everything you see and hear is transmitted from your senses straight to the computer, who records it all and analyzes it and feeds you back the relevant information. So literally everything you see and hear is monitored at all times for signs of treason. And treason is punishable by instant summary execution by the other player, by the other player characters, because you get points for it. And we've gamified the entire thing. There's no money in this world. You get XP points, which is, it's a role-playing game. Just XP points. XP is experience points.
Yes.
So they're experience points. And this is a joke that we hammer relentlessly throughout the books, and it very very quickly stops being funny, and then at some point starts being funny again. So you've that's basically it. You're in a group of characters who are trying to survive.
Yeah.
Except you can't trust anyone, including the people who are supposed to have your back. They've got your back, and they're planning how to stick a knife in it, basically. It's great. I'm really pleased with the work we've done on it. It's taken longer than we expected. But again, I had it in the player book earlier this week,
mm-hmm.
and which has turned out to be the thing that has most of the rules in it.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to get the GM book and the adventures done in the next few weeks.
So that would be end of the year then, or next year?
It'll be out next year.
Yeah,
Go to print in January.
Okay, cool.
Is the plan.
Where can people find you if they're looking for any game design advice or consultancy or workshop? You have your Twitter, you have a website. I'll put the links up, but
they can find me. The consultancy's website is space.com with three A's. I'm jameswallace.com, james@jameswallace.com, or james@space.com. On Twitter, I'm @jameswallace.
Yeah. So thank you so much, James. This has been a fascinating conversation.
It's
really,
been a
really
pleasure.
Helpful.
It's been really
and,
interesting.
Yeah, and see you soon. Thanks.
Yeah, look forward to it.
Well, that was our fifth episode and the last one of 2015. Thanks again for listening. If you enjoyed it, as I said at the beginning, please tell a friend or leave us a rating or review on iTunes or a thumbs up on Stitcher. I'd really appreciate for more people to be able to find and listen to the show. You can also find more Ice Cream for Everyone goodies to read or to listen to on the main website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net, all the words spelled out. If you haven't yet, please check out the Ice Cream Sunday email newsletter, where I write a new story based on personal experiences, current events, whatever else I find inspiring every week. You can also get the Ice Cream for Everyone updates on Facebook. You can look up and like our page there to get the updates on a regular basis. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @HippoWill. On any of those platforms, you can leave feedback, ask questions, and same, I don't hesitate getting in touch if you have a question about your branding or your marketing strategy. I'm always happy to help and always happy to give advice or give advice to your own branding. And have an awesome New Year's Eve. Until next time, have fun. Bye-bye.